All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here for the next episode of the Mix Zone Women's Soccer Podcast. This is podcast number 85, a very important number. 1985 was the first year of the NCAA Division I Women's Soccer Tournament that was not won by North Carolina. The Tar Heels had won the first three titles, the first three NCAA titles, that is, 1982, 1983, 1984, but George Mason defeated the defending champs 2-0 in 1985 to win that school's first national championship. The game-winning goal was scored by Pam Bowman, who earlier that year had been part of the first ever U.S. Women's National Team games. Those were played in Italy. And since August 1985, 210 women have been capped for the senior U.S. Women's National Team. If you haven't seen it already, last summer I created a gallery quality print commemorating all the players who were capped during the first 30 years, which is actually 205 players. You can check out the design at society6.com, that's the number 6. Just search for USWNT. So much to talk about today, so much happening in this so-called off-season. The first conversation for today's episode was with Steph Young of starsandstripesfc.com. Since she has a law degree and writes intelligently about WOSO issues, I thought Steph would be the best person to talk to about the legal dispute between U.S. Soccer and the U.S. Women's National Team Players Association. Please note that Steph and I chatted before the Players Association filed a counterclaim Monday, if that's what it's called. I'm not sure what the official phrase is. Lots of issues on both sides here, and there will be more coverage of this to come, of course. For the meantime, I recommend following Steph on Twitter. She's at Thrace, or Andrew Doss with the New York Times for well-informed updates. Then I had a great chat with Monica Gonzalez, former captain of the Mexico Women's National Team and current soccer broadcaster, as well as founder of Gonzo Soccer Academy. Monica and I covered a variety of topics related to CONCACAF and the Mexico Women's National Team. The struggles of these players really helps put the U.S. Women's National Team legal debate in perspective. So check out these two conversations. Hope you enjoy it. All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here with Steph Young from Stars and Stripes FC. Steph, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Jen.
Now, who would have thought, you know, you having a law degree and being a women's soccer reporter, another soccer reporter too, that those two categories would kind of overlap in such an interesting way over this past week?
It's been happening with more frequency over the past year or so. I don't know if that's an ominous sign or what.
So maybe, you know, maybe it's time for, along with your Two Drunk Fans podcast, that you start like a legal soccer podcast?
God, no. I came to soccer to get away from the law, Jen. Oh my God.
Well, anyway, let's pretend that that I know very little about the lawsuit and that listeners know very little. So Wednesday, this press release comes out from U.S. Soccer saying that, you know, they regretted to inform everybody, but they had to file this lawsuit against the Players Association. So explain it to me in pretty simple terms.
Just a little bit of background. The Players Association and U.S. Soccer had a collective bargaining agreement. And that one was scheduled to end at the end of 2012. And then, and at the end of 2012, they would have this new document, a memorandum of understanding, that would carry over for the next 4 years and include all the terms of the old CBA with, you know, they negotiated a few points that needed to be changed. But essentially, it was, we'll carry over the old CBA until the end of 2016 and then negotiate an actual new one for 2017. So for a couple years, they chug along. We come to the year 2016, and all of a sudden, it seems, U.S. Soccer is announcing, oh, we have to sue the Players Association to get this declaratory judgment, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a judgment where the court declares something. And we want the court to say that this memo is a valid collective bargaining agreement because the Players Association is trying to claim that it's not valid. They, you know, fudged a few things like an actual term or an end date, and because it's not valid in that way, they can terminate it at will, and that's what they're doing now. So we'd like you, the court, to step in and say, hey guys, you have to abide by the rules of this memo, which is in effect a CBA, and that includes not going on strike. So that's what U.S. Soccer wants.
And it's in the CBA, Memo of Understanding, it's not like the power is all in U.S. Soccer's hand. Much like the players can't strike, U.S. Soccer cannot lock players out.
Yeah, it's on both sides. No lockout, no strike, I think.
And the players have had a collective bargaining agreement since, I think, 2000. And the lawyer for the Players Association had been the same lawyer up until fall 2014, I believe. And so now a new lawyer took it over at the end of 2014. And he's the one saying, or at least he's the one addressing U.S. Soccer and saying, we don't think this is valid.
Correct. So the old guy, Mr. Langle, signed the original CBA in 2001. And then in 2014, around November, December, the new executive director of the Players Association became Rich Nickel, or Richard Nickel. I don't know if he prefers to go by Rich. Sorry, Richard. Richard Nickel apparently took a much more aggressive stance and started trying to negotiate with U.S. Soccer, saying, well, actually, I think we need to move up the schedule on collective bargaining because I'm not waiting any longer. I want us to bargain now. And you can imagine why, because they have so much more bargaining power right now, pre-Olympics, pre-qualifiers, pre-She Believes tournament. So you can imagine bargaining now versus waiting until the summer's over and spending a few months bargaining before they're going into a two-year period with no major tournaments. Maybe you'd want to move things up.
I find it interesting that he chooses now, not because of that, because that explains a lot, but that I guess maybe they didn't want to do anything before the victory tour. You know, I almost feel like your most powerful time could have been right after the World Cup, but maybe someone's thinking, hey, we don't want to sour how people feel about us. But, you know, my personal opinion, obviously clearly not a legal opinion or maybe a balanced opinion. It's just like, I don't think this is right, but that's me. I mean, because I can't imagine that they would have been changing lawyers right then. I mean, maybe he's just looking at, you know, like you said, it's like, okay, now we're on the cusp of qualifying, the cusp of She Believes. And that makes a very limited time, you know, as the Olympics is approaching to get things done. So, you know, I think you're right. The most power is in their hands. Now, if the court rules in the player's favor and says, no, it's not a binding contract, you do have the right to strike. You do have the right to terminate this memo of understanding. What are the kind of things that can happen?
They're fine through the end of Olympic qualifying because the date that Mr. Nichols gave to U.S. Soccer, I believe, ends about 3 days after the qualifying tournament ends. So they won't be going on strike anytime before then. But if they do go on strike, and apparently you have to give the Olympics your roster a couple months in advance, right? So if they do go on strike long enough, then U.S. Soccer either has to name a replacement roster, which who do you call up? Unless, you know, you end up taking a U-20 squad, essentially. Or you withdraw from the Olympics, in which case they could get fined by FIFA. Although I think the fine's not terrible. It's like a five-figure amount. And the more serious of the sanctions from FIFA could be that U.S. soccer's national teams, not just women, but men's, women's, and youths, could be barred from future FIFA events. And I think that's partially what they're worried about. The losing face, having to withdraw from the Olympics, and possible sanctions from FIFA.
Let me throw this out there. You know, say they do strike and U.S. Soccer does want to send a team to avoid fines and possible bans. Do you feel it would be impossible to put together a competitive team?
Or just
impossible to put together a gold medal winning team?
Well, I think there's two things to consider on both sides of this. One side is, yes, they have plenty of talent I think they could look to, not just U-20, but some older players like from NWSL. So I think you could pull in, you know, your Keelan Winters, etc., and maybe put together a decent squad. But on the flip side of that, some of these older players who have been fringe national team players may want to stand in solidarity with their former national team teammates. So some of the older players, despite being called up for U.S. soccer, may actually say, I don't know. Is it worth it to me? It might be worth it to some of them to go to an Olympics when previously they would have never had the chance to play a senior tournament for their country. It might be worth it to some. For some others, knowing that after that, they're still not going to be on the national team full time, and they might have burned some bridges with friends or people they respect, it might not be worth it to them. I don't necessarily judge in this situation because there's so much at stake either way. I'm just saying there's a lot of factors. So yes, they could pull together a team, but it obviously won't be as good as the first 18 players they would have preferred.
Yeah, of course not. And that leads me to another question that, you know, one of the things that could be affected if the court rules in the players' favor is NWSL. So
yes.
I kind of wonder about, you know, those NWSL players, those top ones that never seem to get the call-ups anymore or never have, you know, like Keelan Winters, you know, that, you know, to see this public document, which, you know, she may have understood this information already, that clearly says, you know, national team players will always be paid more than NWSL, you know, so it's like, so does that make you think differently about if you are called up as a scab? But separate from that, let's talk the general effect on NWSL that ruling in the Players Association's favor would have.
Sure. Well, I mean, look at the list of allocated players. It's obviously going to impact some teams more than others. For example, Boston would lose currently no one. Oh, God. Well, Whit Engen.
Yeah, you had to think about that for a while.
I'm sorry, Whit. I actually really do like you very much as a person. And, you know, she's pretty decent center back, too, just not quite at the international level. You know, nobody's Becky Sauerbrunn, so it's not really an insult against Whit Engen specifically. Yeah, and then some other teams may suffer more. Like, I think the impact to the Breakers of losing Whitney Engen is way less than the impact to, say, the Houston Dash, losing Carly Lloyd, Morgan Bryan.
Or Kansas City.
Yeah, Kansas City is already having a tough time of it. Like, they've already lost A-Rod and Sydney LaRue. Or not lost, those two are temporarily out due to pregnancy. They already lost Lauren Holiday to retirement. So I think, yeah, they'd lose Becky Sauerbrunn, Heather O'Reilly. But I think they're already reeling so much. They'd be like, what's another problem? We're already working on it. Just come on, bring it on. Shovel on more garbage onto the pile. We can deal with it.
We're ready.
Yeah.
Well, and how does this affect, I mean, okay, one, if I am a player with Canada, you know, an allocated player,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know, how do I not feel resentful of, like, seriously, you're bringing this league down, you know? I mean, that's my thought towards those national team players, but
I see Canadian players looking at the United States having troubles with their federation, and you have to imagine they would feel some sympathy. I mean, it's not like Canada soccer has always been behind the women's team either.
Right.
It's gotten a lot better recently, much, much better, especially now that they've realized that their women's team, you know, is much, much more popular than their men's team.
Well, a big challenge for Canada, which I think a lot of us as women's soccer fans forget, is since Canada has not qualified for a men's World Cup since 1986, they are not a wealthy federation by far. We tend to equate U.S. and Canada, you know, it's like, you know, they're as strong as we are. They should be able to do this. It's like without that huge, huge check, and I'm talking, what, 40, 50 million that comes in when your men's team qualifies for the World Cup. That, you know, they've got no way to fund women's soccer the way U.S. does. I mean, I know that the Canadian Soccer Association would love to have more domestic friendlies, but, you know, there's a cost to that. And I would assume that they put so much of their resources into last summer, you know, and I think they really have taken women's soccer to the next level. But I feel like, you know, knowing what we know now, having seen the CBAs for the U.S. team and seeing what the players are paid, we know that Canada players are nowhere near that,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I just wonder if there's a, you know, it's like, could ruling in the U.S. players' favor bring down the league? I mean, on the cusp of its historic fourth season.
Could it bring down the league?
Yeah.
I'd like to think that at this point, NWSL is slightly more stable than that, and that it could get along without its national team players for a little bit while the strike works itself out. Because, yes, the national team players definitely help attendance. We saw the bumps in attendance after the World Cup last year. But I think at the fourth season, it would actually be interesting to see how well clubs stand without big name players. And I think that among fans who are going to go anyway, it's not going to make a difference. You know, people right. aren't going to cancel their season tickets because, well, some people might because Alex Morgan's not going to show up, but how helpful were those people going to be anyway?
Well, that's and that's a business question where you and I are talking from a fan side, but the business side, and this is something that I keep learning over and over. It's like, you know, you said, you know, those people, the people that are going to go anyway, it's like, well, we have those people. We need more people to go. Mm-hmm. And how you get more people to go is, you know, connect with a name or someone that they've seen on TV, you know, that kind of thing. And I think about if I'm an NWSL club owner, and I've just been told that my two or three name brand stars whose salary I don't have to pay are suddenly not available, you know, I'm kind of pissed. You know, does that, maybe it doesn't bring down the league now, but it, you know, changes an investor's mind on, you know, do I want to expand into this league? Do I want to stay in this league? You know what I'm saying?
That's true. It does make the league seem more volatile than is maybe reassuring for investors. Yeah. I really don't think it would bring down the league.
It would just be a different struggle for the league.
It would be a different struggle, and I think it. And I actually think once the strike was resolved, the league would bounce back pretty quickly. So, yeah, there'd be a little depression, but I think the league has functioned under austerity conditions for so long, even though they're expanding and they've got some MLS money in there, they're still in that kind of wartime mentality of, okay, we have to, like, save as much as we can and
they should. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't all of a sudden become profitable. And even as crowds grow, and then you still have to make up for those years where you weren't making money. So, you know, yeah. you've got losses to cover and there's new things that we know the leagues and the clubs want to do. I just hope that if the court does rule in the Players Association's favor and there is a strike, that it's something that is, you know, resolved quickly and hopefully painlessly, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because the longer it goes on, the worse I think it is for everybody. I don't think anybody comes out looking like a winner after that. And, you know, we know that the U.S. players have such a great following. You know, U.S. fans are so into them and their popularity has never been higher. But, you know, nobody is invincible. Nobody's reputation is so sterling that, you know, maybe just a wrong legal turn doesn't bring it down, you know. Mm-hmm. But let's talk the other side of things. So say the court rules in U.S. soccer's favor, you know, what are those players then? I mean, how do the national team players feel, especially now that all the details of the collective bargaining agreement are out? And then what do they try to do when the memo of understanding does expire at the end of 2016?
Well, for the rest of 2016, it's status quo, essentially, although admittedly, it's probably a little frostier at U.S. Soccer headquarters. You know, you're not going to be getting too many friendly texts going back and forth between labor and management. But I would hope that when it came time to renegotiate for 2017, after the Olympics were over, that U.S. Soccer wouldn't hold it against them, even though they probably will. And would try to push back pretty hard on whatever next CBA there is, instead of maybe allowing the team to, instead of conceding a few things to them. I'm really not sure, because I can't speak for the players in how they would feel if they had to go on as before. We already saw that they were able to institute some change based purely on the optics of the situation when they boycotted in Hawaii over field conditions. And that wasn't necessarily, I mean, I think that was maybe a prelude to all this CBA stuff. It might have been even a dry run. The situation, like the circumstances were right. They aligned. They're like, okay, let's see what happens. But just from the fallout of that and the bad press alone, the team is now scheduled to play on grass fields so far through 2016. Now, I can't speak to the quality of those grass fields, but on the surface, they've already forced U.S. soccer into changing their modus operandi.
But keep in mind that U.S. soccer doesn't control where CONCACAF Olympic qualifying is played.
That's true.
So the Hawaii game had nothing to do with where the February games are being played. And keep in mind, too, that fall versus spring is a very different beast when it comes to scheduling venues. I think I would say the biggest failing of the Victory Tour, and I'm just making an operational guess here, but I've been involved with enough soccer events to have some clue of how this works. I would imagine that they waited a little too long to schedule some of those games. And since they are tied to TV, they can't come in and go, you know, different venues and go, okay, we want to be on this day, you know, or just work with the venue to figure out the best day. They already have a day and a time slot that they have to make happen. So then they're kind of stuck with, well, okay, these are the venues that are actually available that day that are of a certain price so that we don't lose money on this game. Because as we saw in the CBA, you know, the players take money from those Victory Tour games. So, you know, if you're U.S. soccer, you can't afford to lose money, you know, on those games. And I also think it's interesting, you know, Brazil, of course, none of those games will be on turf. I think we just came off a horrible turf year. And I think a lot of fans might need to be reminded that, again, U.S. soccer has no control over where the Women's World Cup is played. You know, I think it is ridiculous the number of games that were played on turf for the Victory Tour, but it's not as easy as a solution as we think it is, you know, especially when you have so many MLS venues now that are grass and self-controlled, but they're smaller than where the Victory Tour wanted to go to maximize attendance.
So are you saying that every game being on a grass field in 2016 is actually a nice coincidence?
So far, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, because think of it. Of the games in 2016, only four have been scheduled by U.S. Soccer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. CONCACAF, Olympic qualifying, not scheduled by U.S. Soccer. Now, of course, they're hosting, and they probably could have, you know, ended up putting it on turf. But, again, it's a different time of year. February, think about it. There's MLS venues don't have anything scheduled. So mm-hmm. It's much easier. And of course, U.S. soccer not controlling where the Olympics are being played. So at this point, so far, it's a pleasant coincidence. But historically, I mean, if you go back and look at the 2012 Victory Tour, there were some turf games as well. Fall is really tough, especially with the bigger popularity. Like, you know what, they had, 44,000 at Pittsburgh? Like, there's no MLS venue that large that's not on turf.
Yeah, that's true. If CONCACAF qualifying had picked a Northeast venue, although why would you in February?
But in this hypothetical,
if they had, they'd almost certainly be playing on turf because all the grass is dead.
Right, right. And what's funny is, you know, I mean, that turf field in San Antonio that they played at, you know, just after the Hawaii cancellation, that's a pretty crap field, but at the same time, in 2015, the U.S. men played there. They brought in grass to put over the turf at significant cost. But, of course, they could afford it because they were playing Mexico, so it was a sold-out venue. But get this. The Mexican team almost refused to come out of the locker room and play because the sod that had been brought out to put over the turf was so crappy and not seamed well together and all that stuff. So there's different issues, different dangers when you're putting grass over turf.
Yeah.
So again, just point out that it's like there's no easy, like, here's the perfect field to play on. And hey, let's be honest, there's some artificial turf fields that are really, really nice. Those are not the ones that the U.S. women got to play on this fall. But there are turf fields that are you know, decent.
I was talking to, I have a podcasting partner, her name is Gab, on our podcast, Two Drunk Fans, and she was saying, we really need to rephrase this debate as not turf versus grass, but it needs to be about playing surface, regardless of whether it's turf or grass, because there's great turf and there's bad grass.
Yes. Yeah. I heartily agree with Gab. It's about the quality of the playing surface. I've seen grass fields for Gold Cup games that I've worked in Houston where they were so bad, they brought the green powder paint to throw on them. And the players are like, are you kidding? We have to play on this, you know? And also, you know, When Megan Rapinoe tore her ACL, I know there's a lot of people that automatically associated that with the turf field. Didn't happen on turf, happened on grass. We heard it was a poor quality grass field, but even on the highest, nicest, wonderful grass field, you can still tear your ACL. So, you know, it's like that's kind of something to separate from that. But I think, you know, I'm glad the topic's coming up in that, you know, I don't want us ever to have to be in a situation where an entire Women's World Cup is played on turf again. I mean, I feel bad for Canada. You know, they were the only people that bid. They made it work. And you kind of understand why they put turf in Moncton to make all the fields the same. But it's just not right.
Yeah, I don't blame Canada for doing the best with what they had. I think the blame lays on FIFA for accepting a standard like that.
Yeah.
Canada just met the standard. That's yeah. All they were doing. They were like, you guys, nobody else is going to do this. So, you know,
we'll do it.
Yeah.
I love the reporter that asked in late May at one of the press conferences for the Women's World Cup, you know, how much Canada had bribed FIFA to host the World Cup. And I think the guy's reply, I think, was hopefully something really simple, just like, well, we were the only people that bid. So, like, I hope they didn't pay any bribe money.
Does Canada even have bribe money?
I know.
Bless
I
his
know.
Heart.
So it's going to be, it continues to be a very interesting NWSL off season. You know, we thought it was going to go a little quiet. No, it hasn't gone quiet. You know, if anybody thought February was going to be quiet, nope. Nope, the drama just keeps happening. So we finally have Olympic qualifying kicking off this week. Mm-hmm. So why don't you give me some of your thoughts about the U.S., you know, the roster and who they're facing in the group stage. They've got Costa Rica Wednesday, Mexico Saturday, and then Puerto Rico Monday.
Right. I think this group is much harder than Canada's group, actually. You'll have to remind me, but I think Canada is in with Guatemala,
Trinidad and Guyana.
Yeah, and Guyana. So in our group, Mexico has traditionally been kind of the third power in CONCACAF in women's soccer, although they had some recent troubles, issues. And I think Costa Rica is now making a run towards being that third player in CONCACAF
right.
over Mexico,
right.
Which means I think this group is substantially more dangerous than Canada's group. But that doesn't mean I don't think the United States won't win it.
And the good thing for the United States, if they do win it, because Canada's group is so weak, whoever second place is in that group, and you know it's not going to be Canada, whoever second place is, I mean, you've set up the easiest possible semifinal for U.S. soccer. I just think it's really unfortunate, and I've seen CONCACAF do this multiple times, that the seeding, there was really no attention paid to it. So when they did the draw, it just seemed to be like, whatever. Like, the only seeding, I think, was okay, U.S. is A1.
You and know, Canada's,
yeah,
too.
Where,
yeah,
where I would have made sure the four World Cup teams were split so there were two in each group so that you've got potentially the best chance of, you know, your top teams going on. It, mm-hmm. it reminds me of the 2000 Olympics, the draw they did. The only teams they seeded were the U.S. as defending World Cup champions and Australia as the host.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. and China ended up in the same group.
Yeah.
From the final. And Norway and Nigeria. So it was ridiculous. And I think, to me, like, that's not even discrimination, or rather it's a different kind of discrimination. It's just like they just didn't think it mattered.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, we've all seen it's so easy to do seeding, you know. Now, they didn't have rankings then. But I would, you know, based on World Cup finish or something like that. Anyway, I'm digressing. But definitely, I agree. U.S. has the harder group. I think it's going to be more interesting to watch the group stage because of that. That they're not going in against Haiti, you know, or Trinidad. That we could see some competitive fire. You know, last fall, last August, we saw Costa Rica score against the U.S. for the first time ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Raquel Rodriguez having an amazing college season, winning the Mac Herman Trophy. Mexico, I'm really curious to see how they come out and play, you know, Maribel Dominguez rejoining the team, you know, Bianca Henninger from the Houston Dash, now part of their team. But of course, Charlene Corral, you know, left off the squad because she spoke out against Leo Cuer. But of course, I'm going to talk to Monica Gonzalez about that later. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to be interesting, a very interesting tournament. And I wish, of course, that, you know, more of it would be televised on a regular channel. But again, let's bring it back to CONCACAF, give them a shout out for forgetting to reach out to NBC to arrange to have this on TV. But hey, at least we've got streaming, right?
Right. In some ways, streaming can be a nice option because so many women's soccer fans watch online.
Right.
Because it's a leftover from the days when women's soccer wasn't on TV anyway. So we all just watched online.
Exactly.
But now that it is moving towards TV and you see that, and TV does, you know, it does get bigger numbers than streaming online. You just have to look at, you know, NWSL games that are on Fox versus just streaming for free on YouTube, because right. Streaming free online doesn't necessarily mean bigger audience and it's harder to monetize. I'm glad that there's going to be something, but I do wish that there were more. That's my usual complaint these days.
We want more. We just want more. Well, and I'm cool with streaming, especially now that I figured out how to do YouTube through my Amazon Fire Stick and that I can take my computer to the Phoenix. So when we have watch parties, we just, you know, we can do it up on the big screen. Uh-huh. But still, there's a lot of streaming where unless you have that channel on your cable provider, the streaming's not free. You know, so unless you have NBC Sports, you cannot access NBC Sports Live Extra. You know,
yeah.
So unless you have ESPN2, you can't get the ESPN3 streaming. You know, same for Fox Sports. So we're getting there, and thank God for the people out in the interwebs that end up posting all the videos later. So it's all a good thing. But Steph, thank you so much for sharing your legal insight and your, you know, thoughts on the team in general. I always like chatting with you about the beautiful game.
Thanks for having me on, Jen. It's always nice to talk soccer on a weekend with a friend.
All right, Jen Cooper, the keeper here with Monica Gonzalez, ESPN broadcaster, as well as from the Women's World Cup last summer and former captain of the Mexico Women's National Team. Monica, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I had to talk to you with CONCACAF qualifying, Olympic qualifying about to kick off, because you've played in the CONCACAF Olympic qualifying tournament before. And I know, you know, you always follow the Mexico women's team. And, you know, we've seen some interesting tweets come out from Charlene Corral recently because she's not on the roster. So I kind of wanted to get caught up on, you know, what's going on with the Mexico women's national team. I look at the roster for this month, and it's very different from last summer's Women's World Cup roster. So what do you think about the changes in that roster?
Well, I would love for him to have Maribel and Charlene at the same time for once. He always seems to kind of leave important names off, you know, and switch around. But I think it's, you know, it's okay. It's good that he's bringing up the younger players. And that they'll get experience. But yeah, the Charlene situation was unfortunate because she's a player who needs to be on the field. And, you know, it's probably both of their faults. You know, I don't think Charlene handled things very well after the World Cup. If you're going to go and talk to the press like that, you're putting in jeopardy your career from that moment on.
And we've seen that, you know, with other national teams. It's not something that's unusual or specific to Mexico. And I know you've been through your own cycles of being cut from the Mexican national team and then coming back in the fold. So, you know, if you're Leo Cuellar, how do you handle somebody speaking out like that?
Well, I think he cuts them from the team. If you're gone. He can't handle, it makes him paranoid too. He can't handle, you know, well, nobody should, a coach shouldn't, you know, have to deal with that. But I think the important part is for them to have sat down and talked about it. And I don't know that they did. You know, she's been playing in Europe and she's taken seriously her fitness or taken it to another level the past couple years and has grown to be a player that everybody knows in this country and that people want to see. There's no reason why he shouldn't have her, and nothing that I don't think can't be resolved. You know, it's just unfortunate that it seems to be a pattern of Leo, and I don't think people have really paid close enough attention. But he cuts players that are important players as they're becoming stars, as they're on their way up. And I don't even think he notices this. But you can look back at like Ciudad Juarez against Canada. We lost. I was sitting at home on the bench. I had been cut from the team, and I mean, I was sitting home watching on my couch. It was awful. That's why I feel really bad for Charlene. But our center back was hurt the whole tournament. He never called me. I was training every day. And then she ended up having to play in the last game and tripped over herself at midfield. And Melissa Tancredi took the ball and dribbled the entire midfield by herself and scored. And that's how we lost, all of us, our chance to go to the Olympics. But what really bothered me about that tournament was that Edith Mora was there, and she was sitting on the bench the entire time. And she was a Herman Trophy finalist, you know, at UCLA. There's no reason why that girl shouldn't be on the field, you know, helping us out. But because it was a personality conflict, I think with her and Leo, and, you know, he always has tried to, like, push down women as they're becoming stars. And Edith and Maribel and Charlene and myself are four of the people that's happened to.
And that was the 2008 Olympic qualifying tournament, because Mexico did beat Canada in 2004, but 2008 Canada beating Mexico for that second slot to the Olympics. Talk about, you know, how Leo has handled or maybe not handled, you know, chemistry within the team. I mean, you came onto the team at a time when, you know, it's still trying to define itself. And I think you could even say that now, like, is it a team of Mexican Americans, or is it a team of girls predominantly from Mexico? You know, and how do you bring those two together and really make a team? And then, like you say, you kind of throw in Leo's machismo, where he doesn't, you know, something a player says makes him paranoid. And, you know, how do you build a team from that?
Yeah, it's funny, because if you go back and look at all the rosters for every tournament and see where the players were born, you always have almost exactly 10 American-born players. It's like there's a limit, like, okay, I can't put more than 10 or people are going to notice and I'm going to get, like, yelled at. It's almost what it seems like. And I kind of grew, even though I'm one of those players that came from the States over time. You know, now I think it's ridiculous to bring 10 players from the States. I think it's, you know, I think it shows that Leo hasn't done his job of building soccer throughout Mexico. I don't think he's too involved in that, because he's got so much responsibility. You know, the way the national team is, it's Leo and that's it. And even if you're the other coach, Leo's got his hand in the pot. And it's just too much. It's grown too much. He hasn't built a support system, a network, you know, of people that he trusts, because I don't think he trusts people. It's hard. It's frustrating. And it's weird for me to be American born and to be saying that the Mexican national team shouldn't be made up of so many American born players. But that's part of what creates the chemistry problems, because a lot of the girls that come from the States, they don't speak Spanish, and a lot of girls from Mexico, most of them don't speak English. So you have this communication issue to begin with, which is a huge issue, but you also have a cultural difference. You know, the ones from Mexico are resentful against the ones from the States because they don't know the national anthem. You know, when I was captain, how could we have an American captain? And I didn't even realize I had people on the team, you know, plotting against me just because I was born on the other side of a river and I was, you know, the national team captain. That kind of stuff isn't good. You know, and I don't think Leo is the person that likes to get in and, you know, get his feet wet with, like, all our little girl issues and girl problems then. So it's kind of a situation where it's just this really, you know, male figure at the head, and what he says goes, and all the girls, you know, no one will ever speak because they're all too afraid to speak. Pamela Tajonar has talked and Charlene has talked. The girls have talked amongst themselves and come up with plans and things to do. But if there's no real leadership, nobody's going to end up doing anything. And everyone's just going to kind of sit there. And I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of girls that call me crying, mm-hmm. You know, and I can't talk about everything, unfortunately. But I think the time will come soon where Leo is, you know, he's like family to me. He was a dad. I saw him more than anyone else. He was there for me in times when, you know, I needed help and I needed to leave camp to go work on myself. And he was extremely supportive, and I'll, you know, forever appreciate that. But I just think, you know, Leo's mistakes are not really his fault. I think it's more cultural stuff. I think he has the mindset that he's done something wonderful for this country and that he's almost saved a lot of these girls' lives because he's taken them off the streets and they're here playing soccer, you know, which is the case with Maribel and a couple others, but that's not the case with all of us. And I don't think it's okay that our funding has gone up every year. We're traveling to more places than ever before, and yet our rankings are dropping. Our results are dropping. So, you know, you can say and talk and ask all kinds of questions about chemistry and this and that, but I think the first thing you have to look at is results. And Mexico hasn't had results in forever.
And I think it's interesting when you bring up the, you know, number of Mexican-Americans on the team versus Mexicans. Like, sure, it made sense to me in 99 when the program was really young, right? Like, Leo started the program in maybe 97, 98? Something like that? You know, yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't start the program either. He came in, you know, Henry Sosa, a Mexican-American, started the program and came to the Federation and convinced them to put a team together. And then he brought Leo in because he knew that Leo would do just what he did, was bring a bunch of attention because of his name and his experience. That was how it started.
Yeah, that first World Cup for Mexico, which was 99, you know, it's like, sure, populate the team with Mexican-Americans. But to me, it's just really sad that 16 years on, he hasn't developed anything within Mexico that has, you know, like you said, that is giving the results that increased investment should be giving.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't have an answer for that because I know that the talent has gone up. I know the pool has gone up. You know, I'm here in Mexico living here with this foundation. You know, I've got like 350 girls and it's been less than 2 years. And one of them's already on the U15 team.
That's
you
awesome.
Know, and it's like how, and I have another job. This is like, it wasn't that hard. Girls are playing soccer everywhere. They want to play, you know? So it's not just like he has to go do it, but he has to get the Federation to like hire an administrator for women, mm-hmm. you know, build a bigger team and not do everything himself. So, you know, I'm actually telling you this before I'm telling him this, because I told him, you know, before the World Cup, because I'm in the press, so I can't exactly like talk bad about Leo, or he's never going to let me, you know, ask him questions about the team again, which sucks because I'm in the same position as the girls.
Yeah.
You know, but I feel like if I go to him and tell him the things, you know, it's not like he's going to change. But what's hard for us is that we sit there and we feel like we have a coach that doesn't believe in us.
Right.
That doesn't really think that we're capable of winning.
And that's huge. I mean, it's one of those intangibles, but it's huge. And that would affect everybody on the team. And then I look at the U20 CONCACAF tournament in December. You know, Mexico, you know, tied the U.S. 2-2, qualified for the Under-20 Women's World Cup. Little surprise, I think there's maybe just one player from that squad that's on the CONCACAF Olympic qualifying squad. I know that there's a big age jump, but I kind of thought with so many different names being on the Olympic qualifying squad that there would be more from the U20. I mean, do they work together? I mean, it seems like the youth program, or at least the U20s, there's a lot of potential there.
I don't know. I'd have to go check the roster for the U20s. I haven't checked that roster yet. And I don't know. I mean, I'm more excited about our U15s and our U17s. Mm-hmm. Because Moni Vergara has had that group, and she's a player who should still be on the team. But Leo has roped her in and got her kind of coaching, and he's giving her more and more. And I see those girls, you know, and she has that human connection. I don't think Leo knows quite how to, like, you know, connect with – he prefers the more of, like, the dictator type, you know. And so he has all the girls playing in fear. That's what you see out there. That's what you can't see it. But if you know what you're looking for, if you can feel it, that's – you know, when you're watching you don't see the passion, or you don't see that's what it is. And the women are being, you know, controlled by fear rather than inspiration, motivation, playing for their country, you know, whatever their other reason is. And Moni Vergara has all of those qualities. You know, she was coaching me when I played next to her, and she's 8 years younger than me. And she was teaching me and telling me where to move and looking out for me on the field. And I know she is a great coach. So I know these younger teams are getting, you know, more of a taste of her, and we have a league now, a youth league, just 3 months ago at a national level, and that's something done by the Federation. Our Federation has always supported us. You know, when someone goes in and says, let's do this, and or someone from the inside starts pushing, because it's not like on anyone's job description to grow women's soccer. Well, guess what? Now it is. In the Sector Aficionado, there are two young women who are just working their butts off to grow this league and traveling all over, and they've managed a nationwide uniform sponsorship, you know, which the women's national team has never been able to get a sponsor just for themselves. So, you know, I've had people with, like, the marketing guys, I've gone talk to them 10 years ago. I'd go in, they'd see me coming and turn and run the other way, literally. And now, you know, there's a young guy named Victor Alvarado who flew to the World Cup on his own and to consume it as a consumer does and see how people consume the women's game. And I love that he did that,
That's great.
He's bringing it back, sees the value, the social value of growing the women's game in Mexico. Because for me, it's not about World Cups anymore. I mean, the World Cup will serve to make it popular, you know, media-wise, which will help it all grow. But the real reason why we need to grow the game is to help change the culture and to help economies, help lift up the women and help more young girls keep from getting pregnant because they're doing activities and playing sports and they can stay in school. You know, there's a big difference economically between the United States and Mexico. Big difference.
Reminds me of that commercial. I think maybe Nike did it. It was more than 20 years ago, the If You Let Me Play commercial. And it just had all the little girls saying, if you let me play, I'm less likely to get pregnant before I want to be. I'm less likely to stay with the man who beats me. I'm less likely. All those things. And I think it applies, I think, to what you're saying. It's like it's just better culturally and
yeah.
You know, for the community.
You take that campaign and do it in Spanish in Latin America and put it in association with the launch of their women's cleats and women's shorts and women's soccer uniforms that you can't buy in Latin America because they don't bring them down here to sell because they think that nobody wants them.
Right.
That's not true. And if you do it with the campaign, they can actually be the ones to help stimulate a little bit more of that interest. But yeah, girls here are playing and people would love to be able to go and buy women's cut soccer shorts. In the store.
Yeah. And I'm so glad to hear that there is that development on the U15 level. That almost makes me think of, you know, what France started, you know, maybe 10 years ago, like, okay, we're going to focus on the kids that are 14, 15, you know, and develop from there. And then once they did that, like 6-7 years later, you hit the 2011 Women's World Cup and you saw the payoff, you know, for that, and that the number of registered women soccer players in France is like tripled or something, you know. So I think of what the potential in Mexico, where that sport has just been so crazy popular for so long, that, you know, if you got all the women playing, those numbers could be ferocious. Well, and talk about you know, we've got a lot of former NWSL players on the Olympic roster for Mexico, you know, Teresa Noella, Ari Romero, Monica Ocampo, and of course, Bianca Henninger making a move from the U.S. to Mexico since her mother is Mexican. You know, that if she gets capped in this tournament, she is cap tied to Mexico. So, you know, I know we don't have any more Mexican allocated players in NWSL, but, you know, has there been at least a positive influence of NWSL on, you know, on the Mexican national team?
That's a touchy subject. I think, and I said publicly that the NWSL in Mexico sending, you know, allocated players was the best thing that's ever happened to our country. You know, after what happened was that the girls went and most of them weren't fit enough. So from week one, they're, you know, last place in fitness, which I just think should be, you know, kind of a wake-up call to them and to us and to our coaching staff about fitness, because that was like my number one complaint, you know, which ended up getting me in trouble. That's one of the reasons probably I got kicked off the team, was because I would go and complain, like, we need to be running more, you know, and this is what they're running in the States, just so you know, and then that creates tension because it's like, oh, we can't do what you do in the States. And, you know, so it's a big learning lesson for me culturally. But I think that was a big difference, and it affected them a lot. It affected their confidence from day one. If you go in and you're in last place, you know, Denora Garza was a player who every day in camp in 2011, before going to the Olympics, she was sick. She was on fire. She looked exactly like, did exactly what Carly Lloyd does. She's a kind of a power forward, you know, attacking center mid, very creative, can shoot from far out. And then after I got cut, somewhere between there and going to the World Cup, 10 days later, something happened. She called me. Her confidence had kind of gone down. And then by the time she made it to Chicago, she had no confidence. Then she comes in like last place in fitness, and she never made it. She played here and there. The coaches told me she had an attitude problem where if I'm playing on the bench, you know, why play hard in practice if I'm sitting on the bench? Like, roll my eyes. Like, you know, these are lessons that we're supposed to learn when we're 13 and 14. Right. You know, and Denora Garza learned it at 22, going to play pro for the first time in the U.S. because she was playing in a culture where they value values and teaching them in young kids through sports. So Denora started playing soccer for her first real girls team was the national team at 18, 19 years old. So the NWSL, I think, served to show there's a big gap in a lot of things, but I don't think Leo has sat down and really, like, truly looked at that. What he looked at and what he saw was that girls weren't playing, they weren't getting minutes, they were, you know, obviously frustrated, and instead of having conversations with them and their coaches about, okay, what's the next step, how do we do this, how can I motivate you, here's an opportunity to grow and get better, this is why you're here, and you know what, maybe you're going to have to sit on the bench for a year, because you obviously have steps to grow in certain ways, and I don't think he was patient enough with the league and with that, and you know what, it was costing him money. Or costing the Federation money. That's another thing. Now they're not paying any money. The girls were making $2,000 a month. Now they're not making anything. They're making per diem.
Yeah.
So was that smart to do? Did anybody ask them what they want to do? He said it was bad and, you know, got the girls thinking that it was bad for them. And that's why he pulled them out of the league. And a lot of them that want to go, you know, Veronica Perez will go anyway. And some of them should go. I think. But a lot of them feel like if they go, they're going to get in bad standing with the coach.
Right. But what do they get instead? I mean, you know, when they're not with a club, where are you getting your training? I mean, did Mexico?
They get to be in camp with him.
Yeah.
It's about control.
Yeah. We could go on and on for this about just all the little fascinating behind the scenes details, you know, of how national teams other than the U.S. national team run, where it's like, I think from the outside fans are like, well, they just need to throw more money at it, or they need to do this. But it's more than just the money. It's how the money is invested and who's running the show and, you know, what standards are teams being held to. You know, I think the FMF recently released like a list of, you know, here are our goals for each team for the next year, you know, and here's what we achieved with the previous team. I'm not sure off the top of my head if they did that for the women's team, but I certainly hope that they did. I'll have to look that up, but let's wrap it up with, you know, the tournament that's happening this month. I know you're planning to head to Dallas for the group games for Mexico and then Houston for the semifinals and finals. It's a pretty tough group for Mexico. You know, once again, in my estimation, CONCACAF not really caring about seeding, and, you know, three of its four World Cup teams are in the same group. So how would you call Group A? I mean, is it an easy win for USA or not? And who goes through as the second team, Costa Rica or Mexico? Or do Costa Rica and Mexico just totally surprise the USA and...
I mean, I don't know what I saw in the U.S. team during the World Cup, but I knew that was a team that could end up going on a really amazing streak. And I think this U.S. team is going to evolve into the best soccer that this world has ever seen. I don't know why. I just have that feeling. I think I look at the team. When I look at soccer players, a lot of times I just see like a soccer IQ, you know, and like the players that they have on the team right now, like the overall soccer IQ is really high.
Right. And I love the turnover that we've seen just in the last month. You know, it's like we knew there were going to be some retirements, but when you throw in a couple of injuries, a couple of pregnancies, like suddenly, you know, there's a shot for some younger U.S. players that we wouldn't have expected to have a chance to go to Brazil.
Yeah, I know. Sydney LaRue, I don't know if that was on purpose, the pregnancies and things like that, but just, you know, having Morgan Bryan and a defensive center mid and, you know, being in a kind of an attacking kind of player, and Lindsey Horan too, I think they can roll through this tournament, you know, if they're focused. And I think that they know enough about the past, you know, if they're not totally focused in this tournament, they can get surprised. I don't know if Costa Rica is going to continue on this. You know, they can't continue to grow as exponentially as they have. They're going to have to taper off in a moment. But I do think Costa Rica has really good players. And I think more than anything, they have solidarity. You know, I had a chance to sit down with their coach. She's very young. Mm-hmm. And she has this just belief and drive. And she just really wants to prove something. And I think, you know, you look at Mexico where there's this, you know, really strong male figure and all these scared little women. Or then you have Costa Rica where it's, you know, a younger female who basically has put herself as like one of their sisters. And having that is going to get them far. It's what got them where they are and got them to the World Cup. So I think that will continue. I think that, you know, seeing that is what, when you see that magic and you feel that magic, it's that chemistry that these women have on Costa Rica because of that trust, you know, and all those intangibles. But yeah, it should be Mexico. I mean, it should be Canada and the U.S. going through. I think Canada is still a much stronger team than Mexico, but they're close enough that you don't know what's going to happen. I do think Mexico will end up beating Costa Rica and getting through. That you asked me second place.
And I think, like, U.S., you know, they win their group. They end up with a very weak opponent in the semifinal because of how the seeding worked. And that's why I was kind of hoping that, you know, our semifinals could be, you know, some mix of U.S., Canada, Mexico, Costa Rica. But it's not going to be that way, so I guess I should get over it. but I'm glad to see Puerto Rico, you know, and Guyana, who have never been this far in either World Cup or Olympic qualifying. That's an exciting thing to see. One of the Trinidad players was telling me just how excited Guyana was when they beat Jamaica to make it into this, you know, final round tournament. You know, because that whole qualifying was played in Trinidad. It's just it's great to hear that, you know, there's more, hopefully more federations trying to get into this. At the same time, I'm sad that, like, I remember Panama used to be challenging kind of like for fourth, fifth place, and then, you know, we don't even see him anymore, you know.
Yeah, I know. And Nicaragua is making some movements as well in their federation and their in their country, and maybe, you know, in the next 3 to 5 years we may be seeing them come onto the picture. I wonder, is CONCACAF doing any kind of event during the tournament?
Not that I've heard. You mean like they did during the fall 2014? Mm-hmm. Not, I haven't heard anything about that.
All right, we'll see what we can make happen in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, definitely.
Because at least the federation people that come from all the different countries should at least get together and sit and have a conversation. And I think that the United States, I'll just throw this out there, everyone from Sunil to the players on the team to the equipment guys to people inside the office, all of them need to sit down and have a conversation about what they can do. And I'm talking about the women's game to help other countries. You know, Abby Wambach is in a perfect position right now to go sort of be an ambassador and go help in different countries. You know, how can we help their federations? How can we help them sell their game in their country? It'll be a really big learning experience for the Americans, you know, to kind of like wake up and realize that we live in a bubble because you have to do things differently. You have to, you know, you can do what works and you can show them tips. But there are people in Ghana and in Turks, in Barbados, in, you know, all these different Caribbean countries that are wanting to grow the women's game, and they're realizing the social impact that it can have. So for people in the United States to step up and say, we're in a position where we can help grow the women's game by helping out our enemies. Yeah, it sounds funny, but that's what real collaboration is.
And if we make the Confederation better in terms of competition, it just makes it makes the U.S. better too. You know, it's like, it'd be great.
Absolutely.
It'd be great to have tournaments that are competitive.
14 to nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those 2012 Olympic qualifiers against, I think, was Dominica, and I can't remember the other team, but it's like, it's painful. So anyway.
Yeah. And here's an example. Megan Rapinoe has her summer camp why not call Natalia Gaitan, who is a captain of Colombia, to come up and be a guest at summer camp? You know, you could pay her probably $1,000 and she'll be completely thrilled. And you're empowering a captain of another team, of another country, to possibly go do this in her country and teach, you know, players like Yureli Rincon to do the same thing. Because they got kind of famous over the summer. They did a really good job.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, Monica, thank you so much for all your insight and just opinions on everything that's going on. And I definitely look forward to seeing you in Houston when you come in for CONCACAF. And, you know, good luck with everything you're doing in Mexico City.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, time to wrap it up with the back four. At last, CONCACAF Olympic qualifying is upon us. Final rosters were released Monday for the 8 teams competing for the 2 CONCACAF Olympic spots. Group A action begins Wednesday in Frisco, Group B action on Thursday in Houston. For a downloadable interactive schedule where you can put in the scores and the standings will update, go to keepernotes.com and check out the top article about the CONCACAF tourney. All games will stream live on NBC Sports Live Extra, and a precious few will be on NBC Sports either live or tape delay. See the online schedule at keepernotes.com for more info. And of course, on the website, we'll be providing lots of coverage, so check that out. Also, you can follow keepernotes and Hal_Kaiser at Twitter. Now, if you're coming to Houston for the semifinals and final, you don't want to miss the first ever keepernotes WOSOCO, aka Women's Soccer Conference, on Saturday, February 20th. This is the day between the CONCACAF semifinals and final. And this casual afternoon event will feature fun informational sessions led by Hal Kaiser and myself. Plus, there will be a Q&A with special WOSO guests, including Kalia Ojai from the Houston Dash and also the U20 U.S. women's team. She's already confirmed for the event, and we should be announcing more names next week. For more info or to sign up, go to keepernotes.com and click on WOSOCO on the main tab. If you register by Monday, February 15th, the cost is less, and you'll be eligible for a discount on the first ever NWSL Almanac that Keeper Notes is publishing this spring. That's right, 3 seasons worth of stats and data and pictures. It's going to be awesome. Check out the Keeper Notes Twitter feed for a teaser photo. Next up, the Canadian allocations. At long last, the list is out for NWSL 2016 season. Some new players, some returning players, and some Canadian players no longer on the allocation list. Of course, that doesn't mean they can't play in NWSL. It just means that their salaries are not automatically paid by the Canadian Federation, but they can still try out for teams and try to win themselves a contract. For more information about the Canadian allocations, check out Hal Kaiser's article on keepernotes.com. Last and certainly not least, kit notes, as I like to call it. The new Dash home jersey, the design has been released. Right now, it's only for pre-sale to season ticket holders. But Soccer for All, the store I manage, will carry Dash home and away kits later on this spring. And of course, I can create NWSL team jackets, polos, cinch sacks, and very likely goalkeeper jerseys for all teams. Soccer for All will also carry the new USA home and away 3-star jerseys that are due in late March, early April. And those new kits should have the FIFA World Cup champion patch. As always, email Jen at soccerforall.com with any merchandise questions. All right, so if you're not already subscribed to the Mix Zone, you can do that via iTunes. Just search for Howler. You can also get the podcast via howlermagazine.com or TuneIn or Stitcher. And I hope you like what you're hearing, and I hope you'll share that with other people who might be interested in this podcast. And as always, thanks to PK Ray for making this podcast possible.